Our next speaker is Lisa Pratt, who is a recent law graduate at the University of the District of Columbia, David A. Clark School of Law. She's an advocate for childbirth practices that respect women as autonomous decision makers, including increased access for vaginal birth after cesarean, otherwise known as VBAC. Welcome, Lisa.
It has been said that knowledge is power, and for women who are pregnant and HIV positive, this could not be more true. Knowledge of their HIV status, knowledge of their treatment options, and perhaps most importantly, knowledge that their medical decisions will be respected, including the right to refuse testing or treatment, give them the power to bring a healthy child into being. I'm Lisa Pratt, and I'm going to share with you one woman's story in the abuse and neglect system after her son acquired HIV perinatally, and also how respecting a woman's right to refuse treatment for her HIV during pregnancy can actually achieve the goal of having a healthy baby. I also want to, first of all, correct my, if you happen to have looked at my abstract, it says that I'm an attorney, and that's a typo. I just graduated from law school, and I still have a test in between me and that title. So I represented her, this individual in the abuse and neglect system as a student attorney as part of a clinical program at school. And I also want to tell you that I have no financial relationships to disclose. Is it neglect if an HIV-positive pregnant woman does not take her HIV medication? That's essentially one of the questions that was in my case. My client was accused of neglecting her child. She was pregnant with twins, and one of her children, her twin A, acquired HIV perinatally from her. The allegations included several, there were several allegations in the case, one of which being that she had failed to adhere to her medication regimen when she was pregnant. It also was based on the child's own viral load and on the child's slow weight gain after he was born. And I think I need to also point out to you that without treatment, 25 to 30% of children will get HIV from an HIV-positive mother. This is without taking any kind of medication or without a C-section. With treatment, that does drop to be 1 to 2%. So even when you take medication or you have a C-section to reduce your chance of getting transmitting HIV, the risk doesn't go to zero. So it's still possible to have adhered to your medication, to have had a C-section, and for your child to unfortunately still come out HIV positive. The child in this case was removed when his viral load was at 57,000 copies, and the viral load briefly dropped after treatment in the hospital. And once he was released from the hospital, he went into specialized care. He was removed from the home. He went into specialized care in a children's home, medical children's home, and then into a therapeutic foster care system. And when he was returned home, he was provided with in-home nursing services twice a day that came over specifically to administer his medication. And during this time, his viral load continued to increase. It never even dropped as low as it had been the day that he was removed from the home when it was 57,000. It went up to 90,000, 100-something thousand, 150, 200,000. By the time she was actually found to be neglectful, his viral load was about 250,000. So it's kind of difficult to say that this was an issue of lack of medication adherence when the specialized care who had been giving the medication correctly and on time and it should have been responding properly to the medication, that you can't say that she was neglecting him. But the judge disagreed. So a neglect ultimately was found based on the child's own viral load and his failure to gain weight and not on the mother's alleged failure of adherence during pregnancy. But it raised some very important questions on whether or not it is neglect for a pregnant, HIV-positive woman to not take her HIV medication. I also want to point out, since many of you are probably not familiar with the abuse and neglect system, that these are closed proceedings, meaning that the only people in the room is the the parties that are involved. So the government's there, the parents with their attorneys, the judge, there's a court reporter recording it, and only the one witness who's testifying at any one given time is permitted in the room. Otherwise, no one else is allowed in. There's no visitors that can come in, no reporters that can come in. You can't even have other people like caseworkers come in or other witnesses sit in the room. It's very closed proceedings, and some people say this is good because it protects privacy, but what it actually does is it creates a culture of secrecy, and it allows for violations of due process rights, and also for the judge to consider irrelevant things such as the client's behavior during pregnancy, which is essentially what happened in this case for her to make that consideration, because the courts have ruled previously that it's not child abuse. The behavior of a pregnant woman during pregnancy is not child abuse because it's a fetus, and child abuse statutes were written to apply to living, born children. Okay. I hope we all are following that now. So the right to refuse treatment. All competent adults have the right to refuse treatment. This is a Supreme Court case that says that. From the case, it says, every human being of adult years and sound mind has a right to determine what shall be done with his own body, and a surgeon who performs an operation without his patient's consent commits an assault for which he is liable in damages. So even though this says surgery, it's not just applying to a surgery. It's any kind of procedure or treatment or intervention that happens. And pregnant women do not lose this right because they're pregnant, and they don't lose that right because they're HIV positive. We also need to note that there are still some unanswered questions about the effects of HIV medication in utero. And there's known risks also. Aside from what's unknown, there are known risks, such as toxicity and the possibility of developing resistance to drugs, especially if there's imperfect adherence on the mother's part. And the risk of any treatment must be considered when weighing the benefits. That's part of the informed consent process. So informed consent, citing from the last case, the Schollendorf case that I just showed you, the Supreme Court later ruled, the notion of bodily integrity has been embodied in the requirement that informed consent is generally required for medical treatment. And that's from Cruzan. Informed consent is derived not from a patient's right to reject non-consensual touching, but from the patient's right to self-determination. It involves more than a simple agreement for treatment. The patient's right of self-determination can be effectively exercised only if the patient possesses enough information to enable an intelligent choice. And that's from this second case, the Matthews case on self-determination. And then finally, from another case here, the McFall v. Shrimp, you cannot be compelled to undergo treatment to the benefit of another person without your consent. In that case, it did not involve anything to do with pregnancy. It was about a cousin who needed an organ for another cousin, and he said he didn't want to give it to him. And so they tried to compel him to give it, and the court said, no, sorry, it's sad and unfortunate you won't do that for your cousin, but we cannot compel him to do that. So this applies as well for pregnant women. Informed consent for HIV-positive pregnant women. In order to give that, the informed consent for HIV-positive pregnant women, the benefits of the antiretroviral therapy must be weighed against the risk of adverse events. And that includes the things that I just mentioned, the medical uncertainties, the resistance, and the toxicity as being some of the risks, as well as the benefits, which are to reduce the possibility of transmission. Also, I want to point out that the things that I've listed is not an exclusive list of risks. There's other ones. So this is from the Public Health Service Task Force on Mother-to-Child Transmission of HIV that was convened by the NIH. They put out an entire guideline booklet. It's like 100-something pages on how to treat women that are HIV positive and pregnant. And these are three things that they identified as being the biggest obstacles to the eradication of perinatal transmission. So it's a delay or lack of prenatal care, poor adherence to the prescribed antiviral regimens, and lack of full implementation of routine universal prenatal HIV counseling and testing. Creating a harmonious doctor-patient relationship can help us address all three of these problems. Women should voluntarily, without coercion, consent to testing and treatment. They should opt in to that. It's what they call opt-in, where you let them know they have the option and they make the decision to take it. Testing and treatment should not be mandatory or require that they opt out. What should happen is that counseling should be given to provide all of their treatment options, to provide the option of testing, and to let them know what the the risks and benefit are. Go through the informed consent process with them. And it's important to note that when women are given the counseling and informed consent about testing and treatment, they usually agree to both and stay in prenatal care. This is information that came from the task force that I mentioned earlier. And addressing all of the obstacles that was listed on the previous slide, except for the poor adherence, can be addressed through informed consent and counseling and offering voluntary consent. However, the adherence issue, the poor adherence that was listed on the previous slide, it can also be addressed because if you have a good doctor-patient relationship through the informed consent and the counseling, it creates a good doctor-patient relationship. The patient will stay in prenatal care, and so if there's adherence issues that come up, then they're already in care, and it can be addressed. The doctor can come up with, discuss ways and communicate ways that she can improve adherence or adjust the medication so that the treatment's more effective. Also, the Public Health Service Task Force also says that treatment should be voluntary, and this is a quote from their booklet. It says, coercive and punitive policies are potentially counterproductive in that they may undermine provider-patient trust and could discourage women from seeking prenatal care and adopting healthcare behaviors that optimize fetal and neonatal well-being. Prenatal care is one thing that we know that improves outcomes in pregnancy. And these policies that are intended to force a woman to have testing or to force a woman to accept either medication or a cesarean surgery for care, they undermine that doctor-patient relationship and can chase women away from getting prenatal care. In the case that I talked about earlier, my case that I represented, the neglect case, it's important to note that it was the child's own doctor who was the leading witness to prove neglect. Instead of creating a partnership for treatment, the doctor was placed in an adversarial role, which created a barrier to open, honest communication between the mother and doctor, and a barrier to the child getting optimal care, as evidenced by the increasing viral load after he was removed from the home. And this is the same phenomena that can happen when pregnant women are forced into testing or treatment. So, you know, when you have the doctor that's in a role of trying to force treatment on women, then it's going to destroy that relationship. Oh, I guess that's it. I was really early, sorry. Okay, that's all. Thank you.